I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is,
it's second is a revolutionary moment.
The rocket cylinder drove its mill. I can give you no authoritative information either to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Creative Futurism. My name is John Best.
And I am Kevin J. Anderson. And in our podcast, we talk about creativity and the future and business and unexpected changes and how the world is changing and how we put up with it. And this time we're going to be, it's just me and John talking because we have a great time just bouncing ideas back and forth and brainstorming. But we're going to focus a little bit on paying it forward because as you get more successful in your field, whatever the field happens to be, there's an expectation that you kind of turn around and help the generation coming behind you and give them a leg up. And for myself, I had some pretty rockin' mentors when I was just a brand new author. I had a couple of stories, maybe a first book or two published. And one of the people who took me under his wing was Dean Koontz. And I'm sure most of you know who Dean Koontz is. He's like the mega multi-million selling suspense author, horror author. And he just like helped me learn the ropes and he answered my letters. I'm sure I was this big pest as a geeky kid, just writing him saying, Dean, how do you do this? And Dean, what's your advice on this? And should I take this contract or should I walk away from it? And how do I write a best-selling novel? And Dean was so patient and he kept helping me out and everything. And in fact, I wrote a book with him called Frankenstein Prodigal Son. It was the first book that he ever collaborated with anyone on. And I was his collaborator. And that book sold 1 million copies in the first year. So that's a cool record that I don't know break anytime soon. But when you have a superstar co-author like that, it sort of helps. And my other big mentor was Terry Brooks. And Terry Brooks is a massive, major number one best-selling fantasy author. He's best known for the Shannara series, The Sword of Shannara, and all of those books. In fact, that's a TV series now. And Terry is also just like he answered a fan letter that I wrote him when I was in college, and I still have it, and I kept writing him. And then when I became a best-selling author myself, we would still stay in touch. We'd go out to dinner and things. But the thing I learned most from him was when Timothy Zahn, another best-selling Star Wars author, and I and Terry Brooks were doing a signing together at a Target store. So there was a line out the door and around the block. And of course, that meant that Timothy Zahn and I sat next to each other and just chatted because the whole line was there for Terry, not for us. And we watched how Terry dealt with his fans. The man is so professional and so patient, and he treated every person like they were the most important person he met that day, and he would spend time with them, and he'd shake their hand, and they all walked away smiling. So I learned how to be a real professional author from watching Terry Brooks, and I want to be Terry Brooks when I grow up someday. So those were kind of my mentors, and now that I'm a number one best-selling author, I really wanted to help out other newer authors. And I've spent a fair amount of time doing that, taking my Padawans and leading them through this maze of publishing and promotion and writing. So that's what we want to talk about today is how you can turn around and help the next generation by giving them a step up.
One of the things, I had some great advice. I actually mentioned this in my book, Breaking Digital Gridlock, which, by the way, is now number 200 under banks and finance in the Amazon list. So I'm pretty proud of that. I had some great advice from a mentor as well who said, if you want to move up, you've got to replace yourself. You know, and I think that's legacy kind of stuff that you're talking about there, you know.
Yeah.
And legacy is so important, you know. I mean, here you are talking about Dean Koontz, who, God, Dean, he's got to be in his 70s, I would imagine, at this point.
Maybe just 70. He's not that much. I'm 56. He's not that much older.
Terry Brooks has to be in his mid-70s.
Terry Brooks is in his 70s, yeah.
Yeah. He's so, but here are these guys that took you along and you know that and you've become their legacy. And now here you are creating a new legacy, a whole new group of authors who are, or, you know, and other people who are carrying on the the story writing and the storytelling and just all the traits that you were given. So I think you're right. This is a real valuable aspect of who you are as a professional and who you are as a person and what your character is made up of, particularly to go out there. Because my feeling is that, you know, I know you've been working on getting, additional education so that you can do some of this, which I'm not sure you needed to do. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
I needed to do it because it was a requirement, not because I had to.
Right.
I've got one more quarter left. In fact, my classes are starting a little bit. I'm now, after 140 books published and 56 bestsellers, I have gone back to college to get my master's degree, my MFA, which means taking classes on how to write romance fiction and studying foundational American short stories of the 20th century, and got a class coming up on young adult fiction. And it's not because I thought that I had empty holes in my head that I needed to learn things, but in order to pay it forward and to work, I have been hired as a professor. I'm going to be running the publishing certificate program at Western State Colorado University. So it's in Gunnison, Colorado. It's a great program. I've been out at the campus a bunch of times. They already warmed my heart because they have an entire MFA program that is focused on genre fiction. And for those of you who have experience in like English departments at colleges, they can tend to be a little bit snooty and they look down on people who like write science fiction and fantasy and mystery and Westerns, and because it's not literature. Mm-hmm. So the fact that Western State has an entire MFA program for genre fiction tells me that their head's in the right place. And I think I'm going to fit in there very well. And I'll talk about the whole program that I'm doing in a minute, but they're publishing certificates. So this is about, it'll be a 13-month program that I'll be running and I'll be teaching all the classes for about publishing, from traditional publishing to ebooks and indie publishing and book design and cover design and distribution and editing and reading through the submissions and all of that, that just isn't really taught very well. And of course, I have a lot of experience in regular New York traditional publishing, but I also run my own publishing house, Wordfire Press, that is doing things the new way with print on demand and you do your own book design and things. So I'm doing that. And they're very excited to have me on with all my credits and my enthusiasm for it. But wouldn't you know it, I'm not qualified for the position because you can't be a professor unless you have a master's degree. So even with my life experience, I didn't count. So I've spent the past 9 months now going to Lindenwood University. It's near St. Louis. I've been taking online classes, full-time student or more than full-time student, just so that I can get everything finished by this June because they want me to start teaching in July at Western. So I've been frantically taking classes on personal essay writing and nonfiction journalism and revision classes and editing classes. It's a little bit funny for me to be putting stories through creative writing workshops because I've had them all published before, but it's, you can never stop learning. And even with my credits, I still have a cadre of test readers who bleed all over my manuscripts and tell me all the inconsistencies. And I'm being a student myself, and I'm watching my cohort of students going through and learning stuff and trying to, it's like their eyes are opening up. I had a class on publishing and writing for publication last quarter, and just watching them struggle with the very idea of how to get an agent or whether they should go with a traditional publishing deal or whether they should self-publish their books or how they would promote them. And so I was there in the class and spouting probably more advice than they wanted to hear, but I've been through it all. And this way, once I finish my MFA, I'll be able to be a professor and help out the next generation and take out my new crew of Padawans there at the college.
That's awesome. You know, I think that they're right. I mean, I hear your passion in it right now, and I can only imagine that if I was an aspiring writer, you know, that, wow, I could look at this college and go, hey, one of the professors is a, you know, New York Times bestselling number one author. Why wouldn't I go there You know, why wouldn't I want to learn from the best? And what's interesting to me is that you not only do this, like you're looking at doing it this at the college level, but you and many of your peers put together a writing, you know, like a writing class that you just had recently as well, right?
Well, in fact, that if the thing that might go on my tombstone might be that for what we created. It's something called the Superstars Writing Seminars. And in fact, next February, we're coming up. It'll be our 10th one that we've had every year we've had them. And it started out in that there are so many different writing workshops and writing seminars that teach you like how to plot and how to describe a scene and how to develop your characters. But what was really missing was some genuine nuts and bolts advice on the business aspects of writing, on how to read publishing contracts, which are very complicated, and how to understand copyright law and intellectual property and audiobook rights and ebooks. And so we set it up 10 years ago almost as a business of writing workshop. And so we put this together and taught 3 days of just intensive how to plan your career and how not to be an idiot author, because we were talking, my wife Rebecca and I were talking to one of our big editors at a New York house, one of our Star Wars editors. And the editor was just over drinks, was just venting about how authors can't be bothered to learn their own business, and they never read Publishers Weekly, and they don't understand how book distribution works and how bookstores work. And she was just bemoaning the fact that authors didn't know this. And I said, well, but I know it. I've been studying it for years. This kind of started out, again, a little more than 10 years ago, where we got together with some of our best-selling author friends, our peers, including me and Brandon Sanderson is another best-selling author, and David Farland and Eric Flint. We all got together at my house. They all flew in from around the country, and we spent 3 days just sitting in my living room sharing this information of how do you bump your Amazon ranking and how do you get reviews and how do you sell gaming rights to something. And because when you're a best-selling author, there's not many people who sympathize when you complain about stuff. And so we were able to sit around in the living room and complain about our problems. And we realized that this is information that nobody else was sharing. So we decided to take it on the road. Our first one was in Pasadena, and we had, I think, 50 people attend, 50 or 60 people attend. Every year, we've just been building more and more people, more and more speakers. The one that just finished in the first week in February, they all held in Colorado Springs now. We had close to 150 attendees. We had 17 speakers, and we had professionals in the publishing industry, not just other authors, because the authors wanted to learn as well. So we had, in past years, we have had the head of Audible.com. We've had the head of Tor Books, the head of Bain Books. We had one of the editors of HarperCollins and Shadow Mountain Publishing. We've had one of the heads of Kobo, one of the competitors to Kindle. We've got coming up, Jim Butcher is a major best-selling author. We have Mark Coker, who's the head of Smashwords.
Dean Wesley Smith, right?
Yeah, Dean Wesley Smith, who was one of our guests on this podcast a while ago. We had David Pomerico, who's from Harper Voyager. We've had literary agents. We all got together, and every year we just packed 3 days full of, now and three tracks at a time, most of it. And we just, we meet so many of our new students, and we pay it forward. That's what my whole thing about this pitch is. But here's the other thing. It isn't just like finding somebody to fill the place if you want to move up, but because publishing is changing so much, a lot of our own students know more about the new stuff than we do. And so we can have panels where I'm asking them questions and how do you get Facebook advertising to be effective, or Amazon ads or Google ads, and which ones work, and how do you link your books to promote the best return on your investment and stuff like that. It's something we've now put over, 350 individual people. A lot of them keep coming back year after year because we change the curriculum. But that's, we'll have the link on the site, but you can look up superstarswriting.com and see our instructors. We got the people, we have Jeffrey Deaver coming next year. We've had romance, best-selling romance authors. We've had vampire romance authors, if you know how well those things sell. And we just look forward to it every year, even though, boy, running a conference is a whole lot more complicated than writing a novel.
I have my own conference, AXFI, which you're speaking at coming up. And yes, you are very, very much right. It is very difficult. I want to comment a minute on something I thought was really cool about you when I first met you. So when I first met you, we have a mutual friend and hey, you've got to meet Kevin. And I was like, oh, I'm super excited to meet Kevin. My dad was a huge fan of you. I've read your books. And when I first met you and I started just chatting with you about what I was doing with the podcast and how we were marketing it, you were just all questions. I mean, you wanted to know, okay, well, what are you doing? How are you doing that with Twitter? And what are you doing here? And how are you doing this? And you were definitely someone who I felt like, wanted to learn, to continuously learn. And I think that, as you mentioned, when these students come in who also have their own ideas, it creates this incredible emotional connection, between you and the students and the people that you're trying to work with, that is far stronger than just a student professor relationship, in the sense of caring about their stories, but also caring about what they're doing and you actually taking advice from them. I thought that was pretty powerful. And same thing for your wife, honestly.
Well, and see, the thing is, about 10 or 15 years ago, I was set for life and I knew how to do everything. I knew how my career worked. I knew how my business worked. I knew how publishing worked. All I had to do was just keep writing the books that they kept sending me contracts for. And then we all looked up in the sky and there was this giant asteroid hurtling toward Earth. And we had to make a decision. Did we want to be a dinosaur and go extinct, or did we want to be a mammal and evolve? And we, Rebecca and I, both made up our mind that, boy, we gotta stay one step ahead of this massive changes that are coming. And so we frantically started figuring out how to bring my own backlist back, like my old books. In fact, people might not understand this if you're not in the writing industry. When you write a book and it comes out and then it stops being for sale a year or two later, you don't find it in the bookstore anymore. That's when the publishers let it go out of print. So then I'd have all the rights back, but there was nobody who wanted, there's no other publisher who's going to reprint an old book of mine that didn't sell well enough to stay around. So I have all of these books that I've written that are pretty good books that the fans want to read, because I now have a bigger fan base than I had before, but there's no place for them to get it except for used bookstores. And even though used bookstores are nice and you can find treasures there, they don't do me any good because I don't earn any royalties when somebody buys a used book. And I'd kind of like to earn royalties if I've got readers who want to read my books. And so we figured out how to reprint, reissue our own books, which meant we had to figure out how to design our covers, and we had to lay out the books, and we had to develop the signs, the design for the ebooks, and load them up on the different platforms. And I went to a lot of my writing students who were one step ahead of me there, and I said, how do I do this? And how do we put it on Kindle? And how do we put it on Smashwords? And they were happy to show us. And it really helped by having somebody else on our side. And so that's why we're just so thrilled with the Superstars community, the graduates, because they have formed like the most massive support group you could imagine. And they're constantly exchanging ideas of, I just figured out how to do this. And here's how I put my stories up on Wattpad, or I put my stories up on Wattpad and they didn't increase my sales. What am I doing wrong? And there's also, it's a knowledge base. And I just got invited something called Radish Fiction, like radish, like a carrot, the root. And I had never heard of it. And it's sort of a, you serialize your fiction and people subscribe to it and you receive micro payments. And I didn't know anything about it, but they wanted me to work with them. So I posted to my group of Superstars alumni saying, has anybody heard of this? Has anybody had any experience with it? And we had this flood of responses, and different people had used it. And there was a sort of a wide range of responses. Some people did okay with it. Some people hated it. And I didn't have to waste my own time because other people had been down that road. And in fact, when I am teaching my professionalism classes and workshops, one of my taglines is that I made all the mistakes already, so you don't have to. And that's what it's about. I mean, you need to share your knowledge and you need to pay it forward. And, you know, there is never any downside to being nice to people, to helping people, to giving them a hand up. And I think some people might be worried that if you are training your replacement, what if you don't go one step up? What if you get like knocked out of the loop? Well, writing and publishing isn't really about competition. If he was a best-selling horror author, he's one of our guest speakers last year. If Jonathan Mayberry sells a big book deal, that in no way makes it harder for me to sell a big book deal. And I'm a reader too, so I want him to be successful so I can read his books. And I think that's our thinking in this, in that we all want our group to succeed, and it's paying it forward.
Yeah, and I think you're dead on there in understanding the symbiotic relationship of teacher and student. You know, we just had a really great interview with Jake Thomas, who was an editor at Marvel, and he was talking about how he ran into, of all people, Kurt Vonnegut. Do you know Kurt? I have no idea if you. I've never asked you before.
He's no longer alive, and I never met him. But I think he died. Well, I couldn't tell you, maybe 10 years ago or so. I'm not sure, but I never managed to meet him.
Right. So, but anyways, long story short, the guy invited him out, invited him to his house. You know, I mean, and you know, where would Jake be without that sort of, you know, validation from someone of that caliber? You know, I was fortunate enough to run into Brett King. Brett King has traveled this road before me. The same thing you just said, you know, he's hit all the potholes. And, you know, I just looked, I'm now number 65 under economics and banks and banking in Amazon. And I would not be there were it not for Brett taking me under his wing, who has been on this show, saying, hey, John, you know what, I'm going to help you. And he did. And so, you know, that's definitely paying it forward, and certainly very thankful for the folks to do that. And I will, you know, I have been doing that and will continue to do that. I think coaching also makes us better. So maybe talk about that a little bit. You know, you've talked about how, you know, you've been able to interact with them and learn things, but what have you learned from going through this MFA? What have you surprised yourself with that you maybe think, oh, wow, I might do this genre. I might write a romance novel, or I might, you know, here's some things I hadn't thought of, and it's improved you even at, you know, even in this late, not late stage, but even at this stage of your career.
Well, I want to throw in one quick thing before that, because you made me think of one of the most important things that Dean Koontz said to me, because after I became successful and a best-selling author myself, and I maintained my friendship with Dean, and we went out to dinner, and I finally just looked him in the eye, and I asked him, I said, look, I was just this kid who was writing you for advice, and you were so generous with your advice, and you helped me out on so many things, but I only had a book or two published, and I had some short stories, so I was nothing that was shaking the publishing world, but you kept helping me out and you kept giving me advice. And I said, so what was it that you saw in me? I was amazed myself at how much time that he had spent. And his answer really struck me. He said, well, I actually gave a lot of advice to people, but you were one of the only ones who actually listened. I mean, if Dean Koontz is going to give you advice, who in the world would not listen to him? I can't believe that. But that was one of those things where it really struck me that if you're going to be the mentee or the Padawan, then you should listen to the person that's well ahead of you and figure out what's going on.
Well, let's contrast with like what you just said. So in the time that you reached out to Dean Koontz, I get the feeling you were writing physical letters to the man. Is that true?
Yes.
So you were sending letters in the mail with a stamp on it that he would have to open. It wasn't like you could just easily pick him up on Twitter and go, hey, man, help me out, or hit him on LinkedIn or find him on. Like, we have all these different ways to communicate. You actually sat down and wrote a letter to the man.
Yeah. And I mean, we were both in the Horror Writers of America. So, I mean, we were connected, and I had a way to get him details and to send him a letter. But yes, that was in the days where you actually used like a typewriter to write a letter, and you put it in an envelope and you put a stamp on it and you mailed it out. But I'm sure he got tons of letters, you know, the mailbag full of letters that he would receive every day of fan letters, but he somehow found my stuff out of it. So that I want to put that out there just about being a mentor and having people listen to you. But your question that you asked about what am I learning, again, when I'm teaching at Superstars, when I finish that 3-day or 4-day seminar, I come out of it just my head is full of stuff, and I've got ideas and I've got suggestions and sort of a New Year's resolution list of all these things that I've learned from the students or from the interactions with them. And in the MFA classes, of course, I'm learning how to study things and analyze writing that has always been sort of instinctive to me before. Whereas I took an entire class on the essays of David Sedaris. And I'd heard his name, but I had never read any of his stuff. But I had to fill up my quarter with things. And that one was, for some reason, I didn't sign up for classes early enough. So a lot of things were filled. And I liked the teacher who was teaching it. And I thought, well, I'm just doing this to go through the motions. I'll take this class on the essays of David Sedaris. And if you don't know him, David Sedaris basically writes funny slice of life things, kind of like Garrison Keillor or Irma Bombeck or Dave Barry, those kind of things. And he's got, as you read essay after essay after essay, the guy seems to get into all sorts of misadventures. And he's got family members that you get to know from essay after essay after essay. And his writing style is hilarious. And the way he assembles an essay, he like does a bait and switch. He'll start the first couple of paragraphs with something outrageous that doesn't really have anything to do with the rest of the essay, but by golly, you're already reading it. I learned a lot about writing, say, nostalgia pieces or blogs or nonfiction things by studying these essays of David Sedaris. And I thought that class was going to be just a total waste. In contrast, though, and I'll be a little snarky here, because a lot of the people in academia, the professors are there, and they don't live in the real world. They're living in academia. They're teaching classes for people who want to be writers, but many of them have almost no publication credits of their own as it is. And so I'm in like a writer's workshop, and I've got 23 million copies of my books in print, but I'm being graded by a guy that published 3 poems in a literary journal someplace. So part of, and I'm not an arrogant about that, but listening to them give advice that is just so wrong, I wanted to just sit back and quietly do my time in the corner, but I couldn't do it. I would be breaking through, because one of the things one of my teachers was insisting on was that all of the students should find these literary journals to submit to. And he gave us like websites and a list. And I went through one after another, as my jaws falling farther and farther open and reading these things. These literary journals have a circulation of like 50 copies, and you have to pay them to read your submission. And I remember I went through this rant I posted to all my fellow students. I said, no, 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 that's supposed to go the other way. They pay you to publish something. You don't pay them to publish something. How are you going to make a living if you have to pay them to publish something? And the teacher, and to his credit, he was defensive, but he was also correct in that he said, no, a lot of the people in the MFA program aren't trying to make a living as professional writers. They're trying to be hired as English professors. And to be hired as an English professor, you have to be able to demonstrate that you've been published in literary quarterlies or something. I'm still not entirely sure I get that, but that is some colleges that their professors are published in these prestigious journals. But, you know, they look on it almost as a dirty thing if you've sold a million copies in a year with a book that you wrote with Dean Koontz, or that you've written Star Wars books or X-Files books, or that you've written Gasp Batman comics. I mean, these are things that don't necessarily impress college professors. They certainly impress the fellow students. But I kind of want to get to a more basic comment to your question, because you're talking about why does somebody at my point, what could I possibly learn? But you can always learn. And that I think that sets up the two different types of writers. There are some that just sort of phone it in and do what they've always done. Or there are other ones that try to push the envelope and do something bigger or better or more complicated than before. And that's what makes the writing exciting to me, because if all I'm doing is knocking out volume 73 that's just like volume 72, that's just like volume 71, well, then it becomes like a real job. And if I'm going to do that, I might as well go get hired somewhere that pays benefits. So I really like to keep extending myself and pushing it. Again, it goes back to, this is showing how important the Dean Koontz mentorship was to me. Back when I was starting out, I was writing mid-list science fiction books and mid-list fantasy books. The guy with the sword, the magic sword that has to go slay the dragon and you know, rescue the princess, those kind of things. Dean Koontz, of course, was number one best-selling, huge, epic writer. And I got some advice from him. I said, so how do I write a best-selling novel? How do I get to break into the bestseller list? Because all of us new authors were under the misperception that if all the publisher did was just advertise your book enough, you could sell a million copies. Well, that's not true at all. And Dean Koontz said, the way that you get a book to become a bestseller is you have to write a bestseller. And that a best-selling book like Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code or Dean Koontz books or Stephen King books or James Patterson books or, you know, choose your own, whichever one that you prefer, they have things in them that your mid-list science fiction book doesn't. The story has to have a scope to it. It has to be bigger. It has to relate to a giant audience of people, not just the nerdy Star Trek fan that I happened to be at the time. Dean told me the story that Dean's published, I don't know, probably well over 100 books himself, but he used to crank out a lot of the shorter mid-list paperback books that he would just do four of them a year, five of them a year. He would keep bringing them out. And I think it was an agent that worked with him. He said, look, Dean wanted to step up a level. And he worked with the agent to write this really big book that was Whispers was the name of it. It was Dean's first big best-selling novel, although his numbers were building up and he was getting quite a big audience. But he wrote a book that just pushed the envelope and was bigger and more ambitious and harder and more complicated and just like a step up from anything he had ever done before. And sure enough, that became his first major bestseller. Dean went to his agent and said, boy, that was hard work. I'm glad I finally made the bestseller list. Now I can go back to writing the easy stuff. And his agent said, no, I'm afraid you can't do that, because now that you've raised the bar, you don't get to go backward. You have to always do the bigger books now. And that's what Dean has done. And hearing him tell this story was very, very important for me to hear, because I had to up my game if I wanted to go to the next level. And I learned how to do that. And when I started, this was exactly around the time when I got asked to write Star Wars books. And you can't just phone in a Star Wars book. You knew this was going to sell a million copies or more. And so I had to really study. I mean, my other books were sort of like angry young man books where there were anti-heroes and they had depressing endings and things. And if you're writing a Star Wars book, you have to please the audience. You have to write characters that are larger than life, and you have to have humor and color and a little bit of romance and all this stuff that I had never really put into my books before. And I did that, and my books sold like crazy, and it kicked them up a notch. And then I got asked for a different Star Wars book, which is called Darksaber. It was four or five books down the line when I'm working for Lucasfilm. And I was supposed to basically write the wrap-up to the great love of Luke Skywalker's life. So I'm writing this massive epic story that has this fundamental romance in it. And so I went and read Gone with the Wind. I read The Thornbirds. I read Somewhere in Time. I read, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I read the major big romance novels so I could read.
But you even went a step further, didn't you? Weren't you out there on that really crazy bulletin board system? was it FidoNet or like back before the internet had come out, you were out there participating. Go ahead. You tell a story. Sorry.
It was FidoNet. It was a Star Wars discussion group called Echo Base, I think. This was even before Genie, I think. And so I'm on there posting to Star Wars fans and, you know, getting some input from them. And it was a great experience. It also prepared me for as before that, none of us had been exposed to internet trolls. nobody, we thought, yeah, there are fans who argue about stuff, but the concept of a troll whose very purpose in life is to destroy you is just, holy cow. I never even imagined that there were people like that out there. Rebecca and I wrote a whole series of Star Wars Young Jedi Knights books, 14 of them that we did. And, you know, you hear the loud and angry trolls, but you get along with the 99% of the people that actually love your stuff. But the loud and angry trolls are the things that make your life miserable. And I remember just scratching my head because we actually got a letter, and this was a physical letter that somebody was angry enough to write and mail to us, that he had read the 14th Young Jedi Knights book. And he said, I hated the first one and I hated the second one. And I hated all 14 of them. And this 14th one is just as bad as all the other.
Why keep reading?
Well, that's what we were scratching our heads about. But they're out there. I mean, that it's not just Star Wars. X-Files, there are Star Trek fans who are like that.
Oh, yeah, and you've dealt with those genres, even the Superman, Batman, Superman's The Last Days of Krypton. You are playing with fire, literally. You are playing with, like, with canon that is just beloved and is almost mythology in the American culture. And so
Dune stuff, too. I mean, Dune is the most beloved science fiction novel ever. So just to – and what happens is you get these people that – they wanted to be the one to write the Dune sequels. They wanted to be the ones to write the Star Wars books. Of course, they haven't done anything and they've never published any books. So they never really got off their butts to accomplish anything, but they see no problem in attacking the person who did. But that's just, you know, Tom Cruise gets hate mail and Meryl Streep gets hate mail. And you know, that was a real eye opener for us when we started. And so, I mean, to answer your question, to get back to that, was EchoNet and FidoNet and all this stuff where, you know, we were on Milnet or some
oh, yeah,
internet.
You would have had to be going into news groups using Gopher and things like that. I mean, this is a long time ago.
This also goes to what we were discussing earlier about being a mammal instead of a dinosaur, and all this stuff was happening. And I didn't want to be the old has-been writer yelling at people to get off my lawn. I was involved in online chats and I was on Genie message boards and I had little fan groups. And it goes back to your question. I mean, it's always a learning process, whether it's learning about how to write better and how to plot better or how to do your research or describe things, or how to interact with your fans or how to promote your work, or look, I have a podcast. And of course podcasts are old news now, but I remember I was on as a guest of podcasts and for a long time, and people were trying to encourage me to start my own podcast. And it wasn't until you bought me beer that we actually
So let me ask you this. So Dean Koontz had to step up, and you mentioned this particular book that became, you know, the step up book. So are you saying that the Star Wars trilogies were your step up book, or what was your step up book? What took you from Kevin J. Anderson, you know, disciple of Dean Koontz, to, wow, I'm going to up my game. And from here on out, this is the new bar. Was there a particular book like the Saga of Seven Sons, you know, the works you did there? Or is there something in particular that you feel like was that book for you?
Well, the thing with steps is that there's another step right after it. So the Star Wars books were my first big step up book, because that's when I had to learn how to write a book that a million people would want to read. And I did that I had training wheels on, because it was a Star Wars book. So they were going to pick it up and read it anyway. But if I did a bad job of it, they weren't going to pick up the next one. And what you really wanted to do was write a good enough Star Wars book that they would then buy Kevin Anderson books. And obviously they didn't all do that, but a good percentage of them did. And it was because Chris Carter, the creator of the X-Files, read my Star Wars books that he asked me to write X-Files books. But then the next step up was the Dune books, which, you know, I love Star Wars and I was a huge Star Wars fan, but Dune is something else entirely. Dune is Dune. It was my favorite science fiction book ever. And I think it's the best science fiction book ever written. And to work in that territory was just a huge challenge. And Brian Herbert and I working together were able to, you know, basically Frank Herbert left huge shoes for us to fill and we had to use two sets of feet to fill them. And that was big. And then my Saga of Seven Sons was another big step. And I took what I had learned from the other stuff and I created something entirely my own, which was a 7-volume Game of Thrones type science fiction epic that I still think is kind of my masterpiece. It's got so many things in there, so much world building, so many characters, so many cultures, so many alien races. It just really was the next step up. And then in a different way, when I was working with, again, another one of my idols, Neil Peart, the drummer from Rush, when he asked me to write the novel of their album, Clockwork Angels, and working with him on it, I'm writing the book that's based on a Rush album, and Rush is my favorite group ever, and these lyrics mean so much to me. I can't just knock out a fantasy adventure book. This has to be the best book that I've ever written. And it was, and I just worked so hard on it, and I think it shows, and that book is it's one of my most beloved books. And then Neil and I did another one, Clockwork Lives, which is even better. And so you never can stop getting better, but one of the ways that you get better is by helping somebody, showing somebody below your level, you're being a mentor and showing them, here's how you do it, because learning how to teach a skill formulates it better in your own mind and you learn how to do it better. And I've learned so much from teaching other students. And now that I'll be at Western State teaching their publishing certificate program, I'm going to have to stay on top of things in ways that I never did before, because I'm the expert in the ivory tower. I'm teaching them these things. So, and they're paying money for me to teach them. So I better not give them 5-year-old information. I better give them something that is worthwhile, because if they're paying a lot of money to get their certificate, I want to give them their value.
So I have a question. I don't know if you'll answer it or not, but it's one I've actually asked you before. So one of the things that fascinates me, and I know you go up to your cabin out by Fair Play, which is nearby South Park, which I find incredibly amusing to write, is you've told me
somebody's got to kill off Kenny.
Yeah, somebody's got to get rid of Kenny. But one of the things you've talked to me a lot about is your methodology for writing, which is dictation, which it just blows me away that you will sit down and spout out a universe. And I just, can you speak to that at all? Because I would love to take a class in that. Like, you know, because I can talk so much faster than I can write. We all can. And clearly, you know, your books are bestsellers and I know you're pounding out these great books like the last Dan Shambles and all of that. So maybe talk to that a little bit. I'm so blown away by the fact that that's your process.
Well, first off, I don't sit down and blow it out. The advantage of being able to dictate means that I get to go out hiking and write at the same time. So I can fulfill my two favorite loves here as telling stories and being out in the Colorado wilderness and just walking on trails. And in fact, I found that I got my best ideas by just going out for a walk. And when I was, you know, typing everything, just using the keyboard and typing my stories, and I'd get stuck because I didn't know the character well enough, or I didn't know how to plot the next scene or what was going on. And I would just go out for a walk and I would walk along and just mull things over. And the fact that you're out of the house and you're away from the phone and the cat doesn't want you to play with him, which I'm doing right now as I'm talking, that he's batting a cat toy. you could just get into like a fugue state and just think about your story, think about the world and the characters. And I would go out with a little notepad and jot down notes. But if I was getting a million ideas in a minute, I couldn't possibly handwrite it fast enough. And so I finally started taking a micro cassette recorder with me. So they had the actual little cassettes in them. And I'd go out and I just use it to brainstorm and take notes. And I got, my notes were more and more detailed, fleshing out the scene and choreographing the sword fights or the space battles. And I would take more and more notes. So it got to the point where it was virtually a first draft. And then I thought, well, why not just write this way? Because it's almost like I'm broadcasting a radio play of what's going on, or I'm reading my stuff aloud. It just hasn't been written down yet. And so I taught myself how to think up the sentences and then speak them rather than think up the sentences and type them. It's just like flipping a switch in your head. And of course it takes practice. You don't just, I've tried to teach many, many Padawans that this is a great way to do writing. And I think I've got about a dozen utterly fanatical converts now that do all their writing by dictating just like I do. And they can do it while they're in their commute to work every day, or if they're just going for a walk every night. And you just have to learn how to do it. But a lot of people can't do it until they sort of get over their self-consciousness, and because you're walking along talking to yourself. But it's a lot easier now. When I first started doing it, everybody looked at me weird because I'm mumbling things about axe murderers and aliens. They thought I was like some strange person walking around. Of course, now everybody's got Bluetooth sets or just yakking into their cell phones, so nobody pays any attention to people just talking to themselves. And then I have a transcription service that I send the audio files to, and they transcribe it all. But the point is, you have to learn how to do it. And you didn't learn how to type on a keyboard the first time you sat down either. You probably pecked out 5 words a minute the first time you looked at keys. You learn how to do that. You learned how to type. So you have to learn how to dictate as well. And I do tell people that, you know, I give classes, not full classes, but I use this on how to increase your writing productivity. And one of the things I want them to try is to try dictation, even if it's just taking notes or doing character sketches.
Do you carry around any of the character work with you? Do you have like the characters in front of you, or do you have like some sketch, like, you know, the arc of the chapter you're trying to do? I'm fascinated by this because I just, like you said, I think it's a skill that you can work out. And I did a lot of my book in dictation, but that's just me basically performing a presentation that I've done before where I've gotten my thoughts together. But to create as you go along while you're walking along the forest, these amazing stories that you tell already, I'm just blown away.
Well, I always have my outline. So I know what the chapter is going to be and what happens in that chapter. I have like my notes with me. So it's like a paragraph describing what happens in chapter 12, and then I'll go out and write chapter 12. So it's the difference between, you know, like the summary on the back of a book and then the book itself. So I'll go out and my notes might say, Han Solo and Chewbacca dock the Millennium Falcon at a space station, and nobody's answering their hails, and they get outside into the space station and they find that everybody aboard is dead because of a space plague. That'll be my notes. And then I'll go out and I'll do like sentence by sentence of the Millennium Falcon approaching the space station, and Han Solo on the communications, you know, hailing space station, why won't you answer? And, you know, sentence by sentence, I will flesh it out. But I know in my head what's supposed to happen in that chapter, and I just do the full details.
You know, you teach people this process. This could be like your secret juice, you know, your secret sauce, but yet you're out there going, no. As a matter of fact, I want to teach it to everyone else to make them more productive. And it just comes full circle into this pay it forward concept that you really are perpetuating with your whole life. You know, it's be who you become and who you are, which I think is so very cool.
You know, it's something that I found is more productive. And, you know, there are still, it's like a step up from if you were handwriting things on a yellow legal pad, you find that it's a whole lot faster if you're typing it onto a keyboard. Well, I'm finding that dictating is a whole lot faster than even typing on a keyboard. And again, this goes back to me trying to share my knowledge, because before me, these great authors have share their knowledge with me. And I'm hoping that the next generation that I teach will then help the following generation. So, you know, again, I don't know if the listeners here are like full high-end writers or really dedicated, but the Superstars Writing Seminar is, again, it'll be February 5th through 7th next year in Colorado Springs. And it's high-end. Don't expect this to be like a beginner's writer's workshop. This is we expect you to know a little bit about what you're doing already and have the right mindset that you really want to work hard and learn. And I mean, we have major figures in the industry and major best-selling writers who are there. And of course, I've got a plug. If you do Western State Colorado University, the publishing certificate program, we're actively looking for the first group of people that will be starting this July. And it's almost entirely online. I didn't mention that before. It is a low residency, so you have to come out to the beautiful Colorado Mountains for 2 weeks in July, where we'll meet face-to-face and basically go over what the year is going to be, what we're going to be learning. And in fact, we're going to be doing some projects, doing a real book from start to finish that I will then publish at WordFire Press. We'll brainstorm that. And then the rest of the classes for the next year will be all online. And then you come back to Colorado the following July so that you basically do your wrap up, and we will release the book that we put together and we'll promote it and get reviews for it and everything else. So that's real hands-on, and I'm looking forward to teaching. I've never done anything this extensive before, but you know, I'll have an MFA, so I'll be qualified for it.
Well, that's fantastic. And I think this has been a great episode to really just dig into your mind about that. So for those of you who are listening, we'll have all of this information, including the links to Superstar so that you can sign up if you're interested, links to the college where Kevin will be teaching. We'll have links to Dean Kutz's collaborations with his mentee, you know, and a young Kevin J. Anderson. So what a great way to wrap up an episode. And Kevin, thank you so much for sharing all this insight with us.
Well, and I hope it was an interesting enough episode of Creative Futurism, and we'll try to dig up some other guest next time so that you don't have to listen to me for the whole program.
Oh, no, I thought it was fantastic. And certainly we do have some great guests coming on. I don't want to say it yet till we have him, but I'm super excited about your next book that's coming out. So I can't wait to read it, and I can't wait to have that guest on. And I know it's probably one of the biggest things that WordFire's ever done. So I know we're going to have a big bash over it, and I can't wait to tell everybody, or for you to tell everybody. So very exciting.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Creative Futurism, and tune in at our next one.
You've been listening to Creative Futurism with Kevin J. Anderson and John Best. For more information, go to creativefuturism.com. Thank you.